the one thing I was going to add to where we were before is that one of the sources of energy from my current work is actually seeing these projects on the ground. Because, you know, these are people who have no resources and no sort of sophistication in fundraising or organizational development, but they're making change every day, and so that makes it easy to keep up once.
Do you go on each of the study missions?
Yeah. Because it's a great, since I'm the one who does the most public speaking for the organization, the more I see organizations, the more I have to describe and talk about what we're doing on the ground. And it's the participants on the study tours are either current or future donors, and it's a great way to spend time with them.
Well, speaking about having time on the ground, you've spent a fair amount of time in and around Darfur and in Sudan, and HAWS has taken a real leadership role in the effort to stop the crisis in Darfur. You've spoken around the country. What are some of the joys and frustrations of that effort?
Well, again, I want to clarify, since we're largely an international development organization on the ground, and since we do some relief work after, usually after natural disasters, Darfur is really a sort of unique piece of our work. Here was this crisis which we suddenly became aware of in 2004, and it was a genocide which has unbelievable power and resonance in the Jewish community. And nobody knew anything about it because our newspapers had chosen not to cover it. So over a few months in 2004, we made a set of organizational decisions that we had to respond to a genocide, that we had to provide humanitarian aid and relief to ongoing victims of that genocide, that we could only provide that relief if we could raise money, and we could only raise the money if we became a source of information about Darfur, as well as encouraging the American media to cover it better. And a parallel decision that you can't raise money for the victims of an ongoing genocide without organizing to stop the genocide. So our Darfur work is sort of encapsulates a combination of our base grant-making work, which is only some of our grant-making work, and our advocacy and education work. All of those things, since the summer of 2004, we've raised over $5.5 million, much of which has gone down to everything from water to medical supplies to the creation of a backup structure so that there could be a maternity facility in a field hospital in Chad, to the provision of rape counselors. All of that work has been accompanied by non-stop efforts to educate more broadly, to support something called the Save Darfur Coalition, which is a large interfaith effort to support the student activists who have been the promoters and effective movers of a divestment movement that will increase economic pressure on Sudan. So it's been a story of its own in terms of education, advocacy, and aid. We're very proud of the central role that we've played in the Jewish community and very proud equally of the response from that community. But I would say it's also been challenging and affirming to work on this issue in a much broader interfaith effort. So I guess I think joy is the wrong word, but there's a satisfaction with the advocacy efforts that we and others have developed and with the extent to which we've forced some people in government and in the media to keep looking at Darfur, to keep making statements on Darfur, to keep taking positions on Darfur, and then the unbelievable frustration of knowing that this is a genocide that's just entered its sixth year and that nothing... But everything that we've done has been important, and none of it has been sufficient to actually stop the ongoing.
Do you anticipate that HAWS will continue to advocate on behalf of the people in Darfur?
Oh, yeah. In fact, our vision, which I can't promise you lies, but our vision would be that not only would we continue to advocate, put pressure, get the multilateral United Nations force actually admitted into the country and see the violence stop, but then it is the nature of our work that we'd be there after that, after a large number of people had left, because the people in the camps for displaced persons and the refugee camps, 2.5 million people, when you interview them, which is something I've been privileged to do, they mostly want the violence to stop so they can go home. And if they're really going to go home, there has to be a large humanitarian aid effort to make that possible.
you a lot of help in that effort.
Thank you.
We're going to talk a little bit about fundraising, a little bit more mundane than Darfur, I think.
That's okay.
But you've alluded to various aspects of fundraising for AJWS and other experiences that you've had, so we'll spend a little time talking about that. You mentioned earlier that AJWS does most of its fundraising within the Jewish community. Is that a deliberate strategy?
Well, that's the community that from which we spring, and so it's not, I don't want to say like it's, let me put it affirmatively, we like everybody's money, but as a fundraising organization that has a larger and larger budget to raise every year, it's pretty logical that we would target our efforts to the community that we're most set up to reach. There are lots of ways for non-Jews to support change in the developing world. My personal critique is that unfortunately too many people, including Jews, not just non-Jews, give to organizations that are more about relief than development, to organizations that are a little too heavy, the government grants they get and where and how the government wants them to work. But those are small criticisms. We're very proud of our grassroots effort, but we know other organizations in the secular community that do grassroots social change work. So the target from which we want to build our organization is predominantly the Jewish community, Jewish individuals in so-called mixed marriages, Jewish organizations, but I know for sure that some of our donors are not Jewish. They found us because they wanted to travel with us and then they loved what they saw on the ground. They found us because they really stand and appreciate and respect the grassroots partnering nature of our funding. And so they choose to be affiliated with us, including one very generous donor who's not Jewish, who's a member of our board.
How do you incorporate the education piece within your fundraising, particularly within the Jewish community?
I think that varies tremendously, sort of approach by approach. If you read our materials, if you're on our email list, we do a fair amount of education. That is, the material and information is there. We talk not only about what we do, but how we see these communities. We try to tell stories about some of the work on the ground, and we certainly quote Torah and Talmud and text. I don't know to what extent that's a successful education device, as in that sticks, and how much is just people who say AJWS, I give to them periodically, so I'll send money. So I don't know how that, it's not a formal study course, but if you're asking, is the understanding we have of the Jewish responsibility to work in the non-Jewish world and to assume global responsibility, is that reflected in our fundraising materials and presentations? Yes, and it's certainly reflected in the public speaking that I do.
What percentage of your time do you think you spend on fundraising?
You know what, I think that's an appropriate question given where I am and given your structure, but I actually think it's a frivolous question for the heads of not-for-profit organizations. Actually, everything you do is about fundraising, by the way, including lots of things you do when you're not officially working. So you're meeting people, you're talking to people, you're talking about your work, you're trying to get people to think more broadly about the universe of not-for-profit, not non-governmental work that needs public support. I mean, I'm sure that some of the conversations that I have with people about our work influences them to go home and write a check to somebody else who's been a check that's been sitting on their desk and they haven't written it. That's fine. So, I think running a really good organization, which I made some more, and being sure that flexibility and to quality work is essential to our fundraising. And I spend a lot of time trying to be a good manager of a growing organization. That is directly related to fundraising.
You talked a little earlier about this concept of giving strategically.
Mm-hmm.
And as in the general community, many Jewish philanthropists are narrowing their focus to issues about which they care the most deeply. So if a philanthropist has not yet demonstrated interest in alleviating poverty or supporting economic development, education, and social justice in the global South, how might you engage them in the work of AJWS?
Well, I have the privilege of talking to philanthropists, but since I think everyone's a philanthropist, I'm going to say larger donors, from time to time. The good news is that if they're willing to see me, it's usually because they've already got starting from ground zero. But occasionally I look for meetings or what we might say or else, and so that you're right that they've not thought about this. And a lot of what I do there, in addition to sort of explaining to them what we do and how we do it, is what I think any good fundraiser does, and that is look for pieces of their areas of interest that connect up to the work we do. The most common one of those is I very often talk to people from relatively small, often non-staffed or just one-person staffed family foundations. They may have set up their foundation inside their federation or outside, but they may have set up their foundation for a perfectly good cause, which is to protect children from abuse and neglect, protect the children of Indianapolis from abuse and neglect. When I talk to people with a mission like that, I very commonly say that I think that what they're doing is that, and I would like them to know how small a percentage of American philanthropic dollars go outside the border of the United States. Ask them to consider over time with their family members, with their staff person, with their board, whether they could imagine maintaining their focal interest, in this case it would be on children, but giving to us to do that work globally. And I always tell them that they should be doing 10% of their...
And has it worked?
Occasionally, yeah. I mean, I have a couple of... specifically, actually, about a specific... But the orientation of the parents, for reasons that nobody could ever say, they never explained why to us, but they were a great resource for us, because after every, as they got elderly, one of them died, their daughter took over the foundation, and with great legitimacy, she didn't see this as a very productive use of dollars, because relief is relief, or after the day you write the check, you probably save some lives, but there's certainly nothing ongoing or strategic about it. And her interest was actually in issues of adoption, foster care, abuse and neglect of children. Example, I was talking about it, and I now get a 10 or 20 from her. I don't know what percentage it is of philanthropy, but it's clearly... And she, by the way, does something that we actually let people do if they're giving us generous sums of money. She actually looks through our docket and she says, here are the kinds of programs that you're helping that I'd like to support.
You talked a little bit earlier about raising a lot of money for politics in your political career, and I'd like to explore a little bit about the difference in fundraising in politics as against the fundraising for AJWS.
Well, I guess what I mean, I highlighted that question on your list of questions because once I took this position at AJWS and we started doing more and more fundraising because we were a growing organization and trying to turn one-time donors into long-term donors. And people would say, like, you spend so much time raising. I would say, look, I spent 20 years in politics basically raising money for myself that wasn't tax deductible. This is, like, much easier. I can tell people actual stories of where their money is going to make a real difference on the ground, not to buy, more media for my campaign. So I think that it's... there are lots of bills to fundraising, but it certainly has satisfying to me to be spending time now, as by the way I did in the earliest part of my career, fundraising for an organization, for a community, for people in need, instead of politics costs so much, which is somewhat obscene.
Do you have a vision in terms of growing this budget to meet these incredible demands that you see around the world, how AJWS budget would need to grow to meet them?
Well, let me explain that when I'd been at AJWS for 5 years, which was in 2003, when our budget was about, had gone from about $2 million to, I think, $5 million, my board asked me to do some projections for our growth, and I wrote that door to remind me of how stupid I am. Said that by 2008 we might be able to become a 10. Now a $32 million organization, I want to say. But yes, we're trying to think with the board about the sure we maintain a stable base so that we don't ever have to bring, but to envision some pace of continued growth. Now we're 2008, this is going to be a difficult year, like the kind of growth we've had in the last few years. That's a sober reminder that you have to be careful about this, but I would say without having numerical or year targets, we do think that we can create a larger organization, and right now, that organization would essentially continue to do grant-making service, education advocacy. We're not looking to add programmatic divisions. Our grant-making is becoming more and more sophisticated, more regional. We're encouraging exchanges between and among grantees. Probably would be the case, if I had to make a guess, that 5 years from now we'd have more grassroots projects but in fewer countries. More sophisticated evaluation system. But so we have some notions of the kind of work we want to do as we grow, more than any dollar targets.
But thank you. I'd like to move now to a little bit more general topic of women, politics, philanthropy, and leadership. Having worked with the Women's Philanthropy Institute, I have a keen interest personally in these gender kinds of issues, so we'll work with these just a little bit. Do you believe that men and women lead differently?
Oh, yes.
Can you give us some examples?
I think women are much more, these are obviously generalizations, but more consultative, more inclusive in their leadership and management styles, not always as strong as they need to be in making definitive decisions and laying down the law, but much more likely to build a team that really works together and has a shared sense of mission and is members are supportive of each other.
Well, what you said pretty much describes how others see your style, particularly in terms of being inclusive and consultative. How would you describe your leadership style?
A little sloppy around the edges. But, I mean, really engaged with people. We were talking before about percentages of time spent on philanthropy. I've refused to be the person who is only outside of the office raising the money and basically has no connection with the projects or the staff and turns that over to someone else. A strategy for an organization of our size or at our moment of growth, but it wouldn't be me. I love knowing all of my staff. I love knowing what staff is doing. I write literally and figuratively in a case some articles about this that are very positive, but there are also some critical articles about this. There's some that I've seen in the books about leadership and management of people who actually develop their own strategies in an organization for regularly popping into doors like mine while I'm talking to someone else, because they know that it's my style to sort of stop, take a minute, hear what they want to know, and give them a quick answer. So that's not great. That's a challenge for the people who are working under that style. But I really love being in touch with what's on the minds of individual staff. I like problem solving. I work very hard, and I don't know that this is gender-based, because I can think of some men who do this and some. I'm really interested in hiring people, trying to learn from them, although that's not always, doesn't always make for this.
Did your leadership and management style change from the time you were in politics to the time you're now at AJWS?
No, not at all. So that's why I sort of say that. Certainly this is characterological for me, mm-hmm. as is my general energy and optimism, but I also think that some of it I did organizing, community organizing like this, I did campaigning exactly like this, and I certainly did my time in elected office.
How much of it do you think is a reflection of your academic experiences in social work?
I actually think it's the other way. Interested in social work because it was a profession that emphasized all of these aspects, and I think when I decided that casework wasn't for me, it was very one-on-one, you're not in the middle of the world, you're not looking at all of the different ways to make change, you know, you're depending on ourselves and trying to make that happen, and it's work that was too individually focused.
In both of your experiences in politics and in the nonprofit world, NGOs, have you found any barriers or obstacles because of gender issues?
Oh, sure. I think the good news is we're making some progress on this in the world. And I think that there are a great many women who are affirmatively looking for ways to move up in different sectors, professional or social sector, despite some of these obstacles. So I don't want to suggest for a minute that I feel sort of down by this. But in the Jewish community, it's appallingly common for women to be running organizations, Jewish community, nonprofit Jewish communities now behind the law, medicine, and business in at the speed with which women rise to the top. I'm in a Jewish organization largely because I made a lateral move in Carter. I mean, look, the federated system is one major provide services in their communities. The large city federations have never had a single one. And it's particularly appalling because in those federations, there are large numbers of young and not-so-young women who come to work there, who rise up certain levels, and there are, by the way, a lot of lay activists who end up being more active than any place else. Time to time, members of that lay community in different cities move into paid positions in the Jewish community. But that's bad, then you should see politics. Politics, my biggest concern in politics is just the numbers. Not enough women run for office, not enough women are encouraged to run for office. It is, statistically, this used to be true when I was in government. Statistically, still true, but I would bet it is harder for women to raise money office than for men, not because people don't want to see you move forward, but because there are traps in their brain. So they write smaller checks to women who come to solicit them than men, or I had lots of experiences where I would go and talk to a couple, and because I was a woman running for office, the man would say to his wife after I left, why don't you write the check? And then the wife would write a much smaller check than that man usually writes to male candidates. So there's a constant process of education to keep striking away at these barriers. And look, it's not, there's lots of explanations for what I'm about to say, and it's not the definitive issue, but in all political positions in the United States right now, women hold 40% of the positions, and in Rwanda, women are 49% of the legislature, so.
When you talked about the barriers women have, Jewish women have to become leaders in the major federations, do you think that that accounts for the ongoing strength and vitality of women's organizations in the Jewish community, like National Council of Jewish Women or Hadassah?
Yeah.
I mean, these parallel leadership structures.
Yeah, I think those structures which got set up as a place and a way for mm-hmm. women to be have sort of, I think that's what you're saying, slightly surprisingly grown. They are fierce and powerful organizations in the Jewish community, but that's partly because that's a place where arising, and those organizations are headed by women.
Poverty and issues of equality disproportionately affect women around the world. Does the fact that you're a woman advocate for these issues make a difference?
I actually don't know that, although I want to say that the vast majority of my AJWS staff, including the grant staff, are women. I actually joke pretty often in a growing organization that I'll give a bonus for people who find men for us. I think there are fewer men who want or are attracted to the complexities of this work. Not-for-profit work doesn't pay as well as some other work. And in our case, it's like going out to change the world. I know, for example, that on our service programs, despite the fact, I'm using that quotes because it's not the way I feel about it, but from the point of view of a parent, let's say, despite the fact that we're taking young people to the far end of the earth to live in difficult circumstances, to be challenged by doing physical labor, many more of our volunteers are girls than boys, women than men. So they both rise to the occasion, and I'm delighted to say their parents let them go, or in some cases they're actually excited that that's what they want to do. And I think there's something weird that happens to the men in knowledge, which is that somehow they are getting implicit or implicit messages that time for fun is over, and that they better buckle down, do this, do that, do a summer internship that will lead to another summer internship that will lead to admission to business. But I think it's too bad for the community, and I think it's we're going to start losing some of our best resources unless we think a little bit more seriously about this. But that wasn't the question you asked. Was like the fact, yes, a huge amount of the inequity in the world, in this country, and even more so in the developing world, falls on the backs of women, although therefore it falls on the backs of women and children. But yes, those are complicated problems for women. On the other hand, most of our grassroots organizational efforts are actually started by women and organized by women in communities, all at the beginning, but they're the ones who are determined to make change in the community. And by the way, probably partly because men are so socialized in so many parts of the world that they have to be the responsible figure. And if you're living in a community with no funding, and you're supposed to be responsible for your community and keep your wife in control, and I think that men probably walk around with a much higher degree of depression. I've never gone out to measure this, but I've actually been in communities where you see women essentially running around. They've ended up with all of the tasks. They're responsible for the children. They're responsible for getting water, which is a... And they're sitting and doing nothing. And, you know, maybe they think that's their prerogative, but I also think that, in a sense... So, all of that, so what now, does it specifically help to be a woman advocating on behalf of these women? Actually, I don't think that that's necessary. It does help tremendously to have these women, when we can arrange that, describe what they're doing and to advocate on their... But we have some projects that are run by men, and those men...
Another topic of great interest in the philanthropic community in this decade is this generational difference among donors, among young people working in the office, and you've talked about this a little bit. I'd like to amplify and have you share a little bit about the Young Leadership Program at HAWS for people in their 20s and 40s, what kind of an effort this is to reach the next generation of donors, whether you see a sea change in donor attitudes in the next generation, whether people of this age go on your study tours.
All right, this is a piece of our work that we're really just beginning. So I hope we'll see and do all of those things. Great job with selecting the young people to be part of our service programs, and as you and before, we do a growing job of working with them as alumni to figure out sort of what they're interested in, how do they want to work on issues and problems. We're just beginning to think about all of the ways in which we could bring not just alumni, but young adults in Jewish communities around the country more into the sphere of our work. And we're just doing a little bit more to also target those people in any Jewish community. For sure, and there's a lot being written about this, going to be referenced in the question, the next inheritors of major wealth, what are they going to do with that? So I would say from our point of view, this is still early in its development. We have begun to talk to a few federations around the country, including here, about the possibility of doing what you ready tour for young leaders. So let them babble. I think it could be very powerful to let them see places where comparatively such a small amount of money makes such a difference, especially if you're from a family of wealth or going to inherit some wealth or have made some money yourself and you're looking at taking your first steps into philanthropy. It's a little daunting to discover, in a sense, what makes a big donor in nonprofit organizations here. And so you struggle and you decide, based on two incomes, or to give $20,000 away, and you decide that you'd like to do that to just two charities. And then I know this because I talked to some of these people who are donors of ours, discovered that the two causes that you really care about are organizations that, of course, care about their work. And to them, a $10,000 donation means nothing, and they treat you like nothing. I've talked to people who miss us, not just because their dollars would go so much further practically on the ground, but because they were appreciated for it. I'm going to talk to a woman who's a member of our board who, when she inherited her parents' foundation, greatly increased the gift to us, not her gift to a prominent organization which she'll remain named, parents were supporting. I believe she cut that gift from 50 to 25, or 35. I called her in a minute and a half to thank her and to arrange to meet with her. Never got called by the organization whose gift in half. Foundation, the organization had to be smart. Once she was taking over, they never called her. I mean, what does that say to her about, okay, if you didn't care about losing the first 25, why should I save you the second 25? So I just think this, but we're just building a young leadership program, talking around the country, looking to see what to do. I do want to say sort of two contradictory things. Inspires them, I think there is a growing interest in the rest of the world and in the broad capacity of social change, and I think a role to play in the Jewish community with this next generation and to some extent and what you've asked about, which is Jewish giving does not mean giving only to Jews. Get a lot of those young people. So that's the positive thing I want to say. The negative thing I want to say is that in this next up a community, there is my others to too much talking about what is called social venture philanthropy. They have money to give away, then they should be able to tell the receiving organization exactly what to do with that money and how to do it. That's hard enough if you're Annapolis Center for Children and Youth. It's worse when these individuals, a business person in Indianapolis who has seen a youth group firsthand, watched it grow for 4 years, contributed to it, and now wants to make a big gift, but wants to have a seat on the board, wants to suggest that her money should be given specifically to this area of the program, that still can very often come to be treading on the toes of the professionals. But at least it makes some sense to me. What makes very little sense to me is, and there are organizations like this, that are raising money for projects in the developing world, which they're designing here, which they're encouraging their donors to help them design. Oh, this will be great if we just take this to the Gambia and set this up. And you know what? They actually would tell you, if they were being honest, that some of those efforts have failed. And the sad thing is when an effort of theirs fails, they simply go back to the same drawing board. Oh, well, we should design the program a little differently, or we should try it in a different country, or we should, instead of saying, you know, maybe we should ask the people who live there.
We've talked a little bit about multiple generations in fundraising. What about within your office? I mean, you have a fairly large staff. Do you have several generations working at HAWS, and how does that affect the organizational culture?
I think my staff doesn't know, but every once in a while with several staff in the room, or I'm talking to a donor out of the office with one or two staff members. So the young people who work for me know what I mean, but I think they don't love it, so I should say. But we worked very hard. I believe in this. This actually goes back to the question you were asking me a long time ago about sort of how I work in politics. I love interns. I love college students. I love having a place that will give jobs to people right after college. I hate this notion. I hate the notion, which I think is unfortunately significantly true, but not overwhelmingly, but not totally true. But there's too much truth to the fact that you have to go to graduate school to get a job. I understand why you go to medical school and law school. I understand a little bit why you go to business school, or in getting closest to our area, get a grant. I just know that not all of these young people should need to go to start moving up in the not-for-profit world, because there are no places that do really good teaching about not-for-profit management. Well, there's some graduate schools that are now engaging this. But you know what? You can learn it on the job. And so if I had my total perfect world, I would have inherited an organization that was as small as AJWS, brought people in early in their careers, and figured out, I don't know what the answer is, but figured out the magic rate of growth that would just allow me to then take somebody who'd worked for 3 years or 4 years and put him or her in charge of two other entry-level people. So that's not the case. We haven't grown like that. We've grown like lunacy. Two or three times in the last decade, we've clearly moved in a bunch of more mature people with more job experience. So the answer to your question, which I'm taking a long time to get to, is yes, we have people of several different generations. I thrive on having a bunch of young people. I feel wonderful about what they learn in our office in the extent. A little badly that they feel a little bit as if, as them, they can't move up quite as quickly as they might like. I love having a multi-generational office and the way in which people approach their work, and
particularly if they're taught by somebody who knows what he or she is doing. So given the fact that you think that people learn a lot of this on the job, what advice might you give to younger women today entering either politics or philanthropy?
You know, going back to the very first question you asked me, don't assume you're going to be doing the same thing for the rest, still giving you that message, like pick a profession. With all due respect, even if this is from parents who picked a profession, so let's imagine a young woman who's 20, first of all, they've picked a profession, second of all, half of them are miserable with what they do, not happy, and they're not happy about the notion that now, because they're 50, they're actually going to be doing it for another 20 years. Many of them are therefore looking at early retirement. No criticism if that's what they want to do. But some of them, I know, are looking at early retirement only specifically because they don't want to do they can't afford to. They don't want to do the same thing for the next 20 years. If they had thought 15 years ago about looking for a second job or a different job, they might be a different life. So I urge young people, not, or especially young women, not to imagine this is what they'll be doing. Really try to get experience. We try harder than any not-for-profit organization of our size that I know of. We invest in really good personnel policies and on-site, ongoing professional development opportunities. We certainly already refer people every time to a leadership training program or a seminar in advancing in this in fundraising or in various community. We try to nominate and pay for somebody to meet whatever the criteria are for I'd like to see us do even more professional development. And works for a Jewish organization here publicly thanked us for having. In politics, it's a little more complicated. Politically, I just urge people to work in back positions. They're both starting, but they're different. People who know they want to be in elected office, and there are, I really, really urge them. Particular challenge, people who know they want to run for in general to figure out where you want to live. And harder, you know, for this generation that has opened to them and is a generation with many great stories of people who move from community to community. If you want to run for elected office, then either you have to go get a job where you grew up, which has a great advantage in running for elected office, or you have to decide where to move to and sort of figure out, I'm staying here for 10 years in order to develop a position in the community and make an effort to get elected to office, which may or may not be successful. So that's when I talk to young people who know they want to be in office, they find that just a stagger. But in philanthropy, I couldn't be clearer. I tell people, and I could possibly get for whatever you're going to do going on in the world.